Roll 2d6, episode 16. Welcome to Roll 2d6, with Adam and Nate, a podcast about games, gaming, and gamers.
Hi everyone, I'm Adam.
And I'm Nate.
And we're here to continue our relentless endeavor to come asymptotically close to gaming perfection.
Asymptotally close, that means we'll never quite make it, right?
That is indeed the definition. We can come very close, though. But today we're going to talk about something that every gamer has probably done. You know how?
Oh, hey, this is a family podcast.
Oh, well, we're talking about something else that they probably don't have to do. And you know how when you've played a... Well, I don't think every gamer has done that. I don't know, are we thinking about the same thing?
I have no idea.
let's continue. So you know how when you've played a new game, and after a few plays of this game, you realize there's something missing from this game, and I'm not talking about a rule system or a game mechanic.
Okay.
Because the gameplay's fine, but you realize that if only they had made the components a little differently, or organized the map in a different way, the game would maybe play better, or be a little clearer.
Yeah, you mean like my giant human chessboard in the backyard. You know, it helps me visualize chess. It's less of a highly abstract war game, and more of an actual war game, where I actually make them fight to the death over various things, but I think the pawns are plotting something against me, though.
Well, you should never have let them form a union.
Oh!
That was mistake one. But, you know, I'm talking about modding games. And I'm not talking about rules variants or anything like that.
Okay, so not rules variants.
Not rules variants, but this is something very specific, and I'm going to define a game mod like this.
Okay.
Something that is a new component that you create, which the manufacturer could have done, but for cost reasons, perhaps.
Maybe should have done.
That enhances the game and then becomes the standard way that you now play this game, and not just something you do only at a convention.
Ah.
So I'm going to exclude, like, the big version of awful green things that we played at the convention.
Right, the giant 5-foot, you know, people don't use that giant 5-10-foot ship all the time.
Or the fancy Pirate's Cove version that we played. Something that becomes the standard way you play the game. And this should also be a board game. You know, I'm not talking about RPGs, because RPGs are sold basically as a book, and then you make up everything else that you need.
That's right. Every other component that you do with the RPG is a mod on the RPG, which is just the book. So we're not going to be talking about the RPG, just board games that we mod.
So let me talk... I'll talk about a couple of these. I made a list of some that I've modded. You and I have both modded in the past.
Right. Hey, I get to contribute to this, too.
You do. We've both done these. So let me start with Give Me the Brain, which is a game from Cheap Ass Games.
Yes.
Now, an aside about Cheap Ass Games are basically made to be modded in this fashion. They sell you the rules and a basic game board and cardstock and cards and things like that, but you have to supply your own pawns and money and counters and chits, and if you want to make a fancier board, that's up to you. Because the boards are kind of flimsy. But they're sort of designed to do that.
Right.
But they do have some games they've come out with that are sort of higher quality now, like the new full-color Give Me the Brain.
Right.
And the full-color Lord of the Fries,
yes,
which are, quote-unquote, complete by themselves. You don't need to make any nicer components for these.
Exactly.
But for Give Me the Brain, we did do one addition, which added a whole lot to the game.
Yeah, let me tell you about this. Basically, and we've talked about this before in the podcast, so if you haven't heard us talk about Give Me the Brain, go back and listen to that one. It's essentially a card game where you're trying to empty your hand, and you can only empty your hand if you're in possession of the brain, which is an object within the game. Now, the way that the rules say is the die that you're supposed to roll with this card game is supposed to represent the brain, so whoever's holding the die actually is the person who has the brain. The way that we modded it was got a little foam rubber brain from a novelty store and actually passed around the foam rubber brain instead of just the die.
Yeah, so now when you're playing this and you have the brain, you actually have a little brain sitting on the table
in front of you. Yes, a little tiny gray brain sitting on the table
and
in front of you.
You've played this many times,
yes,
both pre and post foam rubber brain.
Yes.
What was the difference?
It was. I don't want to say night and day because you know that may lead people down the primrose path. And of course, my stock in foam rubber brains companies will go up. But I do want to say that people enjoyed it a lot more. When I would say, okay, it's called Give Me the Brain and here and this, and I'd show them the design. I'd say, this is the brain. We'll pass it around. People would be like, yeah, right, whatever. Now, I mean, these aren't with gamer people. These are people that are over at my house for the evening.
Exactly.
But when I pull out the little foam rubber brain, they're like, aha, I have a brain. And, you know, and they play with it and squish it and say, oh, be careful, don't squish the brain, I need it, you know. And it becomes sort of a, you know, a fun little fetish item that people can pass
around.
Adds
an extra item of fun to the game and makes it a little more visual for
That's right.
People.
So much so that there's a card in there. There's a card in Gimme the Brain that says you found a hand in the back room, and you can use this hand. And what mean hand like digits, fingers, thumbs. You find this in the back room, and I'm thinking of getting
hand.
A little plastic hand so that I can have that as well. So when people play and they say, "Oh, look, you found the hand," I can dig out the little disembodied hand and put it right there on the table for them to use, and have people go, "Oh," and then have people bat the brain with the hand, you know. And that little bit, as weird as it seems, and as weird as it, you know. You'd think, oh, but that doesn't change the mechanic, and it doesn't,
exactly.
You know, and the dice can stand for a brain just as well as anything. Having the little actual foam wooden brain has made people who have played the game with me grudgingly before have more fun with it now, like my wife.
There you go.
It's now more fun for her, and it is more fun for some of the other non-gamers that I play with to have that particular prop.
Very simple little change, doesn't change mm-hmm. the rules at all, but adds a big fun factor to the game.
Right, and so now I never play that game without the foam rubber brain.
So let's talk about another one that you did.
Yes.
And this was Strange Synergy. Now, I think we talked a bit about this, or I talked at length about this in a previous podcast, but why don't you summarize what you did for Strange Synergy
also. Okay, Strange Synergy... For those of you that don't want to go to our other podcast that has Strange Synergy in it, it is a game of individual combat. Everybody has a team, superhero combat. They have a team with each hero on any given team or each warrior on any given team has some superpowers, and they battle it out and try to capture the flag or whatever it is you're trying to do. Essentially, you're trying to whoop other people.
And what are the components that the game comes with in the box?
The game comes with, in the box... a couple of cardboard stand-ups for each warrior. A cardboard stand-up with an illustration on it by Phil Folio in the Steve Jackson Games cardboard stand-up tradition. So you're supposed to make a little triangle out of it. And it doesn't even have a front and back, I don't think. I think it's just a front and front. And there's a little... I think maybe there's a little base to put it in.
Yeah, and
so you've got these little cardboard pieces where the front is the front and the back is the front, and they sit on this map that is folded into quarters or sixths or something like that, so it's a sort of a wrinkly, glossy paper map, and then you have your cards.
And it's serviceable, and it works.
Right.
You can move the pieces around on it, and what is the change that you did to add a third dimension? So
I did. I extruded all of them through the Play-Doh fun factory of the third dimension and pulled them out of 2D and made them 3D. I bought a bunch of HeroClix figures that approximately matched the team members, the warriors, and I repainted the HeroClix so they matched the colors of the game, so that the red team had a predominantly red outfit and the blue team had a predominantly blue outfit.
And these were just HeroClix commons that were really cheap and easy to come by.
Yes, my local comic book shop had what they called the bucket of thugs, and you could go and they just had this big bucket of commons that they'd sell you individually, so I got to pick through them and find a bunch that I liked. I didn't actually spend, I think I spent a total of like $6 on 12 figures, which, you know, 50 cents a piece, I guess maybe that would be a little more expensive than a lot of people might want to spend, but I really enjoyed turning them into actual superheroes or little characters.
You had a chance to do a little bit of miniature painting that you haven't done in years.
That's right, and I had a chance to paint and enjoy and have the joy and the pain that is miniature painting. I redid those, and then all of the powers in the original game, there are little chits for different powers. You have a little chit that's a rifle, and a little chit that is supposed to be an invisible barrier that somebody can create
like force fields.
Yeah, it's a force field. You know, you can create a force field. And what I did is I went through and I also bought little acrylic cubes of approximately the right size to be force fields. And I made or bought other little pieces to stand in the place of these little cardboard chits that end up on the board during the game. So now I have actual miniatures that have real fronts, backs, tops, sides, and they carry little pieces, and when they do powers, those powers manifest themselves as three-dimensional things on the board.
Yeah, and I thought that this really, you know, you did this for the KubaCon convention, and this really made a much nice visual display that brought people in. They wanted to look at it.
It did.
Much more so than, you know, cardboard chits on the board.
Right, cardboard chits and a cardboard fold-up stand-up guy on a wrinkly paper board. I also redid another board. I decided to make it like a holodeck board. It was black with yellow pinstripes across it.
All right.
And all of the pillars and obstacles, line-of-sight obstacles in the game, I also created in three dimensions, so these guys actually had to run around little pillars instead of just having little representations of a pillar on the paper board. So doing this particular mod to the game, and now when I play Strange Synergy, I don't pull out the little the cardboard stand-ups at all. I always just pull out the guys that I made, and I think it adds another dimension and makes it more fun.
It does. I agree.
So that's Adam and Nate's third rule of gaming improvement is add one more dimension to the game, specifically from 2D to 3D, and chances are it'll be even better than it was before.
Turn the chits into little miniatures. Let's see. So let me talk also about Duel of Ages.
Yes.
Now, this is a game that I probably will do a podcast on in the future, so I'm not going to talk too much in detail about it. But anyone who's played Duel of Ages using the rules as they come out of the box will find that there's what I consider to be a pretty large problem. You've got a big hex map, which is the terrain that your characters are running around on, and you and your opponents, a two-player game, each have, you know,
4 to 12 characters.
As many as you're playing with. 12 characters, which are represented by a card that you put on your side of the table, and then a little cardboard chit which goes on the board, and you move that chit around on the map to show where your character is. But every chit is different because there's, you know...
So essentially every character has like a little symbol that's on the chit, and that symbol is also on their card.
That's right. And you get a random character selection at the start of the game, or you choose it in some way. But at any rate, you're going to have 12 icons, 12 little chits that are different from your opponent's 12 chits, and each of the 12 chits is different from each other.
Right.
And you have to remember where they are on the board and which ones are yours.
And which one did you have this game versus which one did you have last game.
Exactly. And it can be not as easy as it should be. So the first thing that a lot of people do when they play this game is make little bases for the icons.
Oh.
And so what I did, and you have white team and black team in the game, is I got some quarter-inch thick foam core board and cut out little hexagons that are exact same size as the hexagonal chits.
Right.
And then for my 12 guys, I put them on little white bases, and I put your guys on black bases. We use sticky tack to stick them on.
Yeah.
And now it's really easy to scan across the board and see, oh, everyone with a white base is the enemy player, everyone with a black base is my player.
Right.
Makes it much easier to visually see who's where and where the teams are.
Exactly. And you're able to see with greater clarity sort of the strategic implications of the board. You know, like, well, gosh, look, they're all clumped over there, so I have a little bit of time before they can make it over here to attack me. And it's much better to do that rather than checking every little individual chit icon, saying, now, which guy is that? That guy is, oh, that's Kit Carson. Okay, well, Kit Carson is not mine. He's the other guy's. And what about this guy? And it cut down on the amount of time we'd spend just inspecting the board by a lot.
Yes, exactly. And this is something that people have mentioned this in negative reviews of Duel of Ages, that they find it hard to keep track of which characters are on which team. And this is a simple fix that changes that. And there's one other thing that I did to sort of organize my Duel of Ages cards that really is another common complaint I see with people have about this game. Now, I have all the Duel of Ages expansions, which means there's, I think, something like 180 characters you can choose
from. Yes, you have these huge decks of characters.
And every character has a card, and they have a little chit that goes with it.
Right.
And what common complaint people have is, okay, I dealt out random characters to everyone, and now I have to dig around in this pile of chits and find all the matching chits.
Yes, I've got to dig to the bottom of 180 chits to find the appropriate ones.
And find the 8 of them that are on my team.
Right.
And that would be a pain. But
the
first time I played this, I saw someone doing this, and I immediately did this when I bought my own copy, is you get plastic card protectors for each of the character cards.
Some of us more ribald people call them card condoms.
That's right, the card condoms that the CCGers love to have.
Right.
So I bought a box or two of those, put every one of the character cards in there, and then take the character chit and just slide it right in with each character card.
Right.
Now, when you get dealt out your cards, you have the chit right there, you pull it out, and then at the end of the game, you just put it right back in.
Right.
There and it's no more hunting and sorting. It's real easy to do.
That's great.
So,
there is one other change that I would like to mention.
Oh, sure.
I would like to make, except that the game itself doesn't lend itself to this change, or I would have suggested that we do it. Every character in Duel of Ages has a certain number of hit points, you know, health points before they die and are taken off the board.
Right.
And as it is, you keep track of their health points now on the card that's sitting in front of you in your own play space and not on...
Yeah, that's the way we do it. We use little gaming crystals or stones to keep track of how many hit points are. Some people just use paper or whatever.
But in some way, you keep track of it, and it's not on the chit itself. And I would like to have, if it were possible, to have sort of some sort of notation on the character chit of how many hit points it has or how many it has left. So when I scan the board, I can see who's weak and who's strong without having to first scan your stack of people and say, well, who over there looks like they might die, and now let me find him on the board. You know, it'd be nice to do that. Unfortunately, the size of these hexes and the chits is so small, I can't think of a good way to do it unless we were to, you know, go vertical and stack it on top of X number of rings of, of that of health.
There's not a lot of space on the map.
And that would be really horrible for the people that have 12, you know, health or whatever. You'd have these really tall Leaning Tower of Pisa dudes.
There's only a few guys that have more than about 6 health. But, yeah, that would be...
So in the 3D Matrix computer-generated version of this particular game that I want to play someday, I want to be able to zoom in and get better resolution on the chits and have the chits actually read me off.
Maybe next time we play, we could put a little die next to each chit or something to indicate. Not most of the players have 4 to 6 hit points, so maybe we could use a little six-sided die.
Teeny tiny six-sided die.
Yeah, and I have a bunch of little teeny six-sided dice, so we could give that a try.
See if I'm just talking out my ear here or if it'll actually be something useful.
So, Duel of Ages, and I will talk about this game more in depth in a future podcast.
Absolutely. Look forward to it. It's a great game, and we would love to talk about it.
Another game that that we made some mods to. I don't know if these are really mods, but some things we did to make gameplay a little easier, more convenient, for Battle Stations. And Battle Stations we talked about in episode, I don't remember, episode 5 or something. That was a
go look
time
it up.
Ago.
It's all at roll2d6.com.
There you go. I encourage everyone to go listen to the Battle Stations review. So for Battle Stations, you have all of your characters are in each of 4 different professions. You'll have scientist, engineer, pilot, or marine.
And in the game, those are represented by their own separate colors.
That's right. All the engineering stuff is blue, all the pilot stuff is yellow, marine stuff is red, and scientist stuff is green. And so one thing I did that was a quick and simple thing to do is I got differently colored pair of dice for each profession. And I hand these out to the players right before the game. So if you're playing a pilot, I give you a pair of yellow dice. The marine, I give a pair of red dice. And, you know, this is... real simple change, but it makes it really clear when someone rolls some dice. Who was it that just rolled those dice?
Right.
And if they get left on the table and the next person rolls dice, you don't get confused about which one it was.
Who did what, right.
Which dice are the ones that were just rolled, because, you know, the engineer always rolls the blue dice. And this, I encourage anyone who plays Battle Stations, get some differently colored dice. It really makes things a lot clearer.
Especially if you play on a smaller table and not everybody has their own full dice rolling area.
That's right. Not everyone has their own dice boot in front of themselves.
Right.
let's see. Another thing I do, instead of using... You have these little cardboard stand-ups for the characters that come with the game. Now, if you... There are Battle Stations miniatures that are out there, which are very nice, and some people have those and have painted those. I haven't done that. So I'm still using the little cardboard stand-ups. And you're supposed to sort of fold over the bottom and make these little triangular tents. And you can do that, and it works fine. But one of the things I saw someone do, and so I started doing this, is using some small colored binder clips.
Right.
And use these as metal bases. And so the pieces stand up on them. You can remove the handles, and then you have little... heavy bases, and the binder clips are matched to the color of their profession. So again, it makes it real easy to see where the Marines are.
Walk down to your local office store and look for the tiny binder clips that are colored as opposed to black or what they usually come in, and you get the ones that match the
Little pack of 50 colored binder clips for
And I really like using those because it's kind of hard to knock those guys over now that they have the little metal base clip. You know, a light brush of wind doesn't knock them over, it doesn't move them, and they have a nice weighty feel to them when I pick them up and move them four pieces and set them down. I really enjoy playing with those additional bases as well.
Definitely. Well, and one other thing for Battle Stations, when you're refereeing this game, as I have often done, you want to know, and the players themselves want to know, how many hit points does everyone have around the table? How many luck points does everyone have left?
Right.
luck is very important in this game, and as a referee, you want to make your players use up all the luck they can.
That's right. You're trying to burn through all their luck as best you can.
The best game is one where the players barely succeed after using all their luck.
Right.
And so it's essential to know, at a glance, how much luck does everyone have left. And so what people have character sheets, and you mark off little squares as you use each luck point, but a thing a lot of people like to do is use poker chips or some other token, like gaming stones, and hand those out to each player. So each person has a little pile of seven poker chips in front of them if they have seven luck.
Right.
And as the game goes, you hand them into the ref as you spend your luck points. And it makes it real easy for everyone to just glance around the table and say, who's got luck? You've got luck. You've got to use your luck to save the ship.
Right, right. And I also kind of like it in that some referees like to use luck, like to bestow luck.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of Battle Station Adventures. I saw this at the con. He liked
That's
to say,
right.
Oh, you have a couple more luck points. And yeah, sure, then the person erases from their character sheet and writes it in. But it's so much better visceral experience to have him toss you a poker
That's
chip
right.
or a coin or something, and you go, aha, I've got it, my extra luck, and you put it down in front of you.
Indeed.
And it certainly helps out with that. And although none of our listeners would ever do this, but I'm sure you've played with people that might fudge a little on the number that's, you know, they'll say, oh, yeah, I use a luck. And if they're down to, like, one luck, they'll say, I use one, and then they'll pretend to erase, and
that's
they'll
right.
still
and,
leave
and
the
no
one on
there. And no one's really keeping track that close. So
right.
you might get away with having a couple extra luck points throughout
right.
the course
right.
of the battle.
So this is just to help normally honest people stay honest as well.
That's right. You have your poker chips.
I'm not admitting to anything, by the way,
of course
by
not.
Mentioning that. I'm just saying that I have noticed it, whether in front of myself or others, I can't say.
And this also reminds me, speaking of using poker chips for luck, because in battle stations, you use luck points to reroll a die.
Yes.
If you've made a roll for your character, it didn't come out the way you want, you can spend one of your luck points and reroll that die. This reminds me very much of Blood Bowl.
Yes.
If you remember in Blood Bowl, there was also the concept of team rerolls.
Right.
And this was something that you could spend some of your team money on to buy spies, which would give you team rerolls throughout
right.
the game. And if a roll went really bad, usually people saved these for if their star player died,
right.
which
right.
only happened very rarely. But you would save that one reroll. Oh, he didn't die. He only got an injured leg or something.
Yes.
And so I found when we were playing Blood Bowl a lot that using I made some actual tokens that said team reroll on them, and I would hand
That's
them
right.
out.
That's right. I remember that.
And so you would have two or three of these in front of you, and then you could turn them into the ref as you used it. And then I made – so those were purple, and then I made an orange one, which was the chant reroll.
Oh,
and
right.
each quarter – because I think we played with even the full quarter rolls.
Mm-hmm.
Each quarter you would make a roll to see whether your fans were chanting louder than their fans.
Right,
because you
right.
had a fan loyalty rating. And so you would
and
make
my
a roll.
Cheerleader helped with that roll.
That's right. You had if you had,
the
official Games Workshop cheerleader
I did.
Miniature.
I did. EW cheerleader. Still
then you
do.
Get to add a bonus to your cheering roll.
Yes.
And so whichever team's fans were chanting loudest, that team got a single chant reroll token. And you oh. could use that as a team reroll at any point. And I do remember... You're talking about the visceral experience of having a token to represent these abstract points.
Right.
I do remember definitely a game where someone had gotten the chant reroll and was holding up and taunting the other player with
That's
it and
right.
saying, look, if you attack me, it doesn't matter if you kill me. Look, I got this. And he's
I
holding it up. And it doesn't make as much sense at this point to your sheet.
To point
say,
to your sheet and say, look,
I've got
a chant reroll. Yeah, but if you hold up the little token and wave it in front of their nose.
That's right.
That's a whole other thing. That's a whole other level of smack talk that everyone loves to participate in.
It is indeed. So, yes, I recommend doing that. Now, when you're playing D&D and you've got your guy with 75 hit points, maybe this isn't such a
yeah,
good idea.
Yeah, that's a big, huge pile of stones. You don't want to have to do
But in
that.
Battle Stations, your characters have, you don't know, at least starting characters have less than 10 hit points, and it's not
right.
that bad.
And they have only, you know, I don't know, half dozen luck points. So
That's right.
And the last one we wanted to talk about was Babylon 5 Wars, which is a spaceship combat game.
That's right. I think we briefly mentioned this in the Battle Stations game, and this was
right.
A game now sadly out of print, but this is a game that we played quite a bit. We really liked it.
Yes. I think I still do like it. I got won over. I disliked
right.
it the first few times, and as time has gone on, I really enjoy it. And in fact, we haven't played it for like a year, so I miss it now.
I know. We should play it again. It's an incredibly complex
game. We're in the middle of Federation
game.
Commander now, though, so
oh, yes.
gotta do something. Anyway.
Anyway, but for Babylon 5 Wars, of course, you're playing with the ships from the Babylon 5 universe, and it's been people have converted Star Trek ships and Star Wars ships and everything. And I think we most commonly played with the Star Trek ships.
Most recently. We
most
started
recently.
Out doing only Babylon 5 Wars until we found the Star Trek ship supplement that somebody had made, and then we started doing that.
Playing the Star Trek ships using the Babylon 5 Wars rules.
Right.
And one of the things in Babylon 5 Wars, you have your capital ships and you have your fighters, and capital ships can generate, they can do electronic warfare against each other. You have a certain amount of sensor points, and you can allocate these either to offensive electronic warfare, OEW, and that makes it easier for you to hit other people, or defensive EW, which basically tries to jam their sensors, makes it harder
electronic
for them to
hit countermeasures.
You.
It's your sensor chaff, as it were.
Exactly. And so with each ship, each turn, you're going to say, oh, I've got 6 sensor points. Am I going to try to defend myself? I'll put 5 into defensive EW, and I'll put 1 on offensive so I can get a lock on to someone else.
Right.
And as you go through each turn, you allocate your DEW and OEW.
And it changes with every ship and every turn. This
That's
is important
right.
to know. It's not like just a statistic. It's something you actually have to allocate.
Yeah, and as you're going into battle, maybe you'll put it more to offensive. Then as you just turn your ship and run away, maybe you'll put it more to defensive.
Right.
And so when each turn then, when you're trying to allocate fire, saying this ship is going to fire at that ship, it's very important to know what is the DEW level of every ship on the board. So I can say, okay, that guy's got 6 DEW, this guy's got 1, I'm going to fire it.
Because you may find something where a guy farther away has less electronic warfare going on, less DEW, and so he's actually easier to hit than the guy right next to you who is totally throwing off warfare static and you can't get a lock on him. And so you really have to know what everybody is at on the board in order to make your firing decisions.
And all the DEW levels are public. These are not hidden. So each turn you reveal one disc. So what did we do to make this a little easier? What we do is every turn, most of the ships are generating, probably 8 or less EW, no more than 8. So each turn we would take a little die, either a 6-sided or an 8-sided die, and put it right next to each ship to indicate how much DEW it's doing that turn.
Right.
This makes it much easier. So now when we're secretly giving our firing orders, we're going through and we can just look at the board and say, oh, that guy's got 4, that guy's got 3, without having to ask Nate every time, what was the DEW on your Constitution class cruiser there?
Because all of your firing orders are secret and they're revealed simultaneously, so all of your fire tracking is planned before secretly, but all the defensive EW is declared publicly.
Yeah.
And so what you would have to do is while you're deciding who's going to fire at what, you'd end up having to ask again, well, ship number 3 you've got over there, what's its DEW? Well, now the person who you're asking knows that you're interested in ship number 3.
That's
and
right.
So you have to ask for other ships you're not interested in
so that
they won't know who you're trying to fire at or how much.
Yeah.
And then it just now you have 5 numbers in your head when you only wanted the 1 and you forget which one is which. And so, or at least this was my problem.
I know. I suppose what we could have done is just every time written down the DEW for every ship on the opponent fleet every turn. But
every
now
turn.
You've got to clutter up your sheet with a whole bunch of other stuff.
You're filling in your sheet even more. You've got to erase it and redo it every turn.
Yeah, so
this is something that should be carried on the ship itself and on the chit. And so I think the addition of our teeny tiny little 6-sided die on there with the DEW ship is so awesome.
Yeah, and this is similar to something I've seen done at cons when people play Battletech, and I haven't played Battletech in a while, but a lot of time when people, after you move your mech, you'll put a little die next to it indicating how many hexes you moved, I think.
Right, or how many inches you moved.
Yeah, and then when people are doing their firing later, it's really easy to look at it and say, okay, that guy moved 4 inches, and so now I know what the to-hit modifier is for him.
Right.
Because there's a modifier based on how fast you moved that turn.
Yes.
Or whether you were stationary or whatever.
Absolutely. So this is sort of a use on that. But
yeah, that was an innovation that I hadn't thought of when I played Battletech back in high school. I remember we would
We'd
play
end up
the
having
game.
To ask.
Yeah,
we'd say, well, how many hexes did
how
you
many
move?
Hexes did that guy move? And maybe we don't even remember. Oh, wait, he was here. Okay, he moved through the hill. Okay, so he must have moved 4 hexes.
Right.
And
right.
It's much easier to just put a die down right after you move.
That would tell you exactly how much.
Yeah.
So keeping track of some of those things all right on the board and on the pieces is in some ways easier. And it's something that they could have done with the game. The game designers, like we're getting back to this, the manufacturers could have added little tokens for how much or a little digital counter of some kind on it.
Mm-hmm.
But due to cost considerations or how they thought to play, they didn't do that. And so these innovations have been really helpful in playing those games.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny to go to the cons and look at the ways that people have sort of adapted games and changed them, not even changing the rules, but just adding these extra little tokens or things, because they find that you know, maybe the game designers played this a bunch of times, but after you've played it at a con 100 times, you realize, oh, look, there's this little area that needs to be streamlined.
There's this little optimization.
this little optimization that makes it easier for me to play game number 101.
Right, right.
Of whatever this is.
Yes.
And, yeah, I suppose some of these people who play the games at the cons are probably more experts than the original game authors were when those original game rules were written.
I wouldn't put money against you on that bet. I agree with you completely on it.
It's just fascinating to see the way people come up with these things.
Yeah. So that's our discussion of game mods. Do you have a favorite game mod? Is there something that you've done? Again, not a rules change, but something that you've done, maybe a little piece that you've made, or something that helps with your gameplay. If so, share it with us at our the comments. We don't have forums, but we do have comments for each one of our episodes. Share it in the comments section at roll2d6.com.
Yeah, that's right. Add a comment. Tell us what change you made to a game that you play often. Something that made the game a little better, a little easier.
Right. Ooh, better yet. Do it, play it, take pictures of it, explain it, and post a link on, you know, put it on the web, and then post a link from the forum, or from the, I'm going to keep saying forum, from the comments, so that we can go back and look at it, because if it's a game we play, chances are we'll pick it up and use it.
Yeah, so. That's right, if you've thought of something good. Or better yet, post it to BoardGameGeek, and then everyone can use it, not
there
just us.
There you go. Well, fine. How's this? I like this better. Put it up on the web. Put a link to it from roll2d6.com in the episode comments. We'll put a link on BoardGameGeek to our comments thread so that people can see and follow
driving
it
traffic
there.
To us.
Right. We'll drive traffic to us from BoardGameGeek.
It's all a scheme to make more people listen to Roll2d6.
You know, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think we could usher in a new world of new world order of peace and prosperity for everyone if everyone listened to Roll2d6.
You say scheme as if it were a bad thing.
That's right. Scheme is not necessarily bad. So
there you go. Okay, send us a comment, send us an email, and we'll see you back next time.
All right.
All right, everyone, that's the podcast, and thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch with us, leave us a comment on the blog at roll2d6.com or send us an email at roll2d6@gmail.com. We'll be back in 2d6 times days. And stay tuned next time when you might hear Nate say,
"Beware, coward, I am Sinistar."